Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 65 of the Alabama Liberal Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about how has coronavirus changed us, and I'm going to introduce a new system for the primary for 2024 or 2028, whenever the Democrats have a real one again, and called the alphabetical primary system. And yes, that means Alabama should go first, and I'm going to explain exactly why that is, but this is a good segue into basically what's going on right now with the coronavirus in terms of it's Easter weekend. There's some kids in my house. I say some kids. They're my kids. They're not just random kids. My daughter's only about 1 year old, so you may hear her cry every once in a while in certain parts, and I apologize for that. But I just watched a episode of Saturday Night Live where the whole thing took place through Zoom teleconferencing and video. So as far as I'm concerned, nothing could be more depressing than that. Coronavirus has changed kind of everything. We've never seen something like this before. In terms of the immediacy of 9/11, I'm not sure that a lot of the country really felt that. Now, of course, with this, we're feeling it in 100 different ways every single day. All these talk show hosts, they're all doing their shows from their house, which is very depressing. I saw where Meghan McCain, she's like, yeah, I'm going gray. And I'm like, Meghan McCain, aren't you my age? Aren't you in your like early 30s? Why do you have gray hair? So the fact that it's revealing exactly how many celebrities secretly have gray hair, I find fascinating. Now that we're seeing a lot of Hollywood celebrities, and I mean, it's men, women, it's everybody. I'm seeing how rough they truly look without hair and makeup people. Kind of makes you feel a little bit better about yourself, doesn't it? Never thought I could do this kind of work before, but maybe I could. America now has the highest death total in the world. We surpassed Italy, according to statistics that I don't believe. I don't believe there's any way possible that China has not had more deaths than we have. I don't believe it's possible for Italy, a country which is literally 5% of China's population, I think that's even remotely possible. How will this change things? How will the coronavirus, how is it going to change us as a people, as a country, as a nation? It's already changing some stuff. Bernie Sanders, the big news is he dropped out of the race. Of course, I celebrate this. I think he should have dropped out a month ago. Keep in mind that episode 61, where I talk about him saying that he would not drop out anytime soon, that was almost a month ago. So he technically did do what I said. I thought he would drop out before he did in the 2016 place, but that's only because he's doing so much worse than he did at that time period. Like he lost Michigan, basically tied in California and Washington. He won those handily last time around. So there's a lot of indications that he was just going to go nowhere but down and put a lot of people's lives at risk. And so let's talk about why he dropped out, why he did that. Of course, a lot of his fans, they say like, well, the DNC, they pressured him out. They bullied him out. Most of these people don't live in reality. All of his biggest victories, like his surprising victory in Michigan back in 2016, which is what he kind of built his whole argument of electability. I'm more electable than Hillary because I beat her in Michigan. Oh, wait, I didn't beat her in Michigan this time. Oh, wait, I was basically tied with Joe Biden in California, which is, for him, that's a horrible result. In Washington State, a state that he should have won handily. Of course, a normal person would have quit the night he lost Michigan and Washington, but then he drags it out another week, Arizona and Florida and Illinois, he gets absolutely killed. I mean, he doesn't come even close to Joe Biden, even tying him, even within 10 points of him in any of those states. And so then at that point, a normal person would say, hey, I have to drop out of the race. There's no way I can win this. It's hopeless. He doesn't do that either. He continues to run for a couple more weeks. Now, there hasn't been a state that's voted since that time period, but that's only because coronavirus has made every state that has any sense push their primaries back. Kentucky was going to go in May. They pushed it back to late June. Ohio, their governor, literally the day before the race, and they should have just went ahead and voted, but he pushed that back to June. The Alabama Senate primary on the Republican side, the runoff between Jeff Sessions and Tommy Tuberville, that got pushed back. That was supposed to be March the 31st. So all these things have been pushed back. That's the only reason there hasn't been more races to come in. And you look at it and you think, okay, Vermont, his home state, they've already voted. Almost every state where he could have expected to do well, like California and Washington, they've already voted. Biden still has his home state of Pennsylvania. And of course, Delaware, the state that he represented in the Senate for decades. So many states where Bernie Sanders couldn't possibly expect to win, like Georgia, like Louisiana, that have not voted yet. Okay, so the biggest states left, New York State, that's Bernie Sanders' home state. Can't even make that work because Hillary Clinton won that. And they said, well, Hillary Clinton, she was the senator from New York, so of course she has an advantage over him in that state. 2016, so far, Joe Biden has not lost a single state. I'm talking about after Buttigieg and Klobuchar and all them. After they all dropped out, he's not lost a single state that Hillary won in 2016. And there's no expectation that he will do any worse in a two-man race. And so if she won New Jersey and New York by a pretty huge margin in 2016, there's no reason at all to think that he wouldn't win those in 2020. And of course, the polls have said that he would win those pretty handily. So if you look at it and you think you're already 300 delegates down, Georgia, Louisiana, Delaware, and Pennsylvania, states where you know you will do badly. If nothing else, there's no optimism in those states. You know you'll lose those by at least 10 points and probably a lot more than that. You know you're going to be at least 400 or 500 delegates down from that point on forward. And then it's just almost like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? Why are you dragging it out? Why are you doing that? So the math just didn't support him. And any other person would have dropped out a month ago. Tulsi Gabbard dropped out weeks before Bernie Sanders did. And I'm thinking the real reason is because, number one, the coronavirus is raging and that's going to shut this primary down. We don't need to continue this primary. This primary could put people's lives at risk. If our base, the Democrats, if they're going out to the polls and they're putting their lives at risk while Republicans don't have any primaries for Trump, by and large, they have a couple primaries, but not anywhere near what Democrats have. We have a lot more primaries. We also have two times the number of Senate races. In the fall, there's going to be 23 Republicans up for re-election. There's only 12 Democrats. So our primaries are a lot more open on the Senate side of things too. So you look at it and you think, we got to shut these primaries down as fast as possible, or for the Senate races, push them back to May, to June, as late as we possibly can and still have a competitive race because of the coronavirus. We don't want our people going to the polls, getting sick, catching this disease, spreading it. I mean, if we have a few thousand more people die in swing states, that could make a big difference. That could lose an entire state. So we don't want to associate the Democratic Party with showing up to the polls, catching coronavirus. Probably as big a reason is the donations have dried up. For some of you that didn't listen to the first 50 episodes, we had an episode about, I can't remember which one it was. I'll try to post it maybe in the link or something, but we had an episode called Our Failed Political Campaigns, The New Ponzi Schemes. And in 2016, it was about how Bernie had lost to Hillary, but he was still dragging it out. For several months, he was getting donations. He was raising money hand over fist. He was talking about, my people, they're broke. They have no money. Give me $20. And I always found that to be really unsavory. Elizabeth Warren does the same thing. She's like, yeah, a college senior who only had $17, they gave me $7. And I'm like, you somehow think it's better to take rolls of quarters from people who are flat broke than to take $200 from a doctor? Like, I don't understand that rationale. That makes no sense. When you have all these political campaigns that are very comfortable taking money from people who have no money, and that's been Bernie Sanders, that's been his MO. He's spent a lot of time being very, very proud that he can get money from people who don't have it. But now, while the coronavirus is raging and there's about to be an imminent recession, I'm thinking his donations have completely dried up. I'm thinking that he's got nowhere near the money that he had. He's already publicly complained he can't do rallies because he likes to do rallies. All the shit that he likes to do is over. The big rallies, the going out there, the bloviating, the being on the news every 5 minutes. The media's like, we have no interest in covering you at this point. The coronavirus is raging. People are dying. You've been pushed to the back burner. He's not in the limelight. He's not the center of attention. He can't do rallies. He can't raise money. He's not getting millions of dollars hand over fist. Even his most hardcore people are like, hey, I just lost my job. They have no money to give him. It almost makes no sense because the stuff he really enjoys, that part of it's over. And then even if by some miracle he wins the nomination and he becomes president, he's going to inherit a huge fucking mess. This is going to be a lot of work to basically be like, somehow we have to get my social programs, which cost trillions and trillions of dollars, through Congress at a time when they've just spent trillions of dollars to temporarily stop the economy from becoming a depression. So Congress is going to be like nickel and diming him on every fucking thing he wants to do. It's a lot of work. He knows that even if by some miracle he wins the nomination, which is not going to happen, and then he beats Trump, even then he can't accomplish anything that he's really talking about doing for all these years. So it's almost like, oh shit. So he drops out to avoid the work, the heartache, the pain of having to do any of the stuff that he's promised. And that's the thing, I feel bad for Joe Biden, because he's going to have the Bernie people who, once he wins and becomes president, and I feel like he will, I feel his chances are better every single day. But once he wins and becomes president, you're going to have all these Bernie people that are going to be salty as hell. They're going to say, well, if we had Bernie Sanders, we would be getting free college right now, and we'd be getting free healthcare right now. And of course, all the politicians are going to look around and be like, free college, free healthcare. We will be lucky to keep the lights on, my friends. There's no way that there's not a recession coming down the pike and that it's not going to be worse than 2008. I think it's going to be the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression. And that's my prediction. Now, you know, every fifth episode, I like to make predictions. Now, back in 64, I kind of gave you a lot of predictions. I talked about stocks that would go up, stocks that would go down, what not to put your money in, what not to do with your money, the fact that there will be a recession. And guess what? Since I released that episode, every single day, the news of unemployment numbers are getting worse and worse, which is exactly what I said would happen. And the stocks that I told you to put money in, Microsoft, Visa, Qualcomm, Apple, they're all up from when I told you to do it. What I'm saying is, there's reason to believe that I know what I'm talking about. The recession, it's here, it's going to get worse. Even once we go back to work in June or whenever that may be, it's still going to be awful. Half the country that's been out of work for 10 weeks, some of them more than that, that have no money, there's going to be defaults, bankruptcies, debts. There will be a worse recession than we saw in 2008. That's absolute honest prediction. If you'd like to hear more about that, I make a pretty good case in 64. I explain it. I go elaborate on it. But for right now, what I really want to talk about is, how is coronavirus going to change us? We know that there's going to be a recession. We know that there's going to be a lot of people who are out of a job. Basically, their jobs have disappeared. There may be some whole sectors that get reordered. There may be some whole companies that go out of business. Sears, JCPenney, probably a couple more big retailers. So what else can we expect to happen? We're watching stuff like Saturday Night Live through Zoom cameras and Jimmy Fallon on his living room floor practically begging people to pay attention to him. Celebrities are miserable because they don't have the spotlight on themselves for a couple weeks. Can we expect that to be the new normal? Because my family, we did a free week of Disney Plus. I don't know if anybody else, like, now is a good time. You could do a free month of CBS All Access, Amazon Prime, Hulu, a free week of Apple TV, and a free week of Disney Plus. Like, now is a good time to do some free trials of all these streaming services. And Onward, which is a Pixar movie, anybody who's got small kids may know what this is, but that got released back in March. Of course, the theaters got shut down almost immediately. I think, like, the third week it was out, me and my son were going to go watch it, and all the theaters were like, don't go to a movie theater, don't put your lives at risk to watch a decent but not that great movie. Basically, Disney released that to Disney Plus, and that was a movie that was only in theaters a month ago and would still be in theaters if they weren't shut down. We enjoyed it. All four of us watched it practically for free. We did it at home. Now, I'm a movie buff. In 2019, I watched probably 100 movies in a movie theater type setting. Alabama Liberal, for those that don't go to the website, every New Year's Eve, I post all the movies that were released that year from worst to best. I basically rank them. So the worst movie of the year, all the way to the best movie of the year. Usually, there's about 200 to 300 movies that I've seen that I do that with, and I give them all grades and everything. Probably the most popular article that I do every year. This year, I mean, I'm going to be struggling, right? I've only seen about 10 or so movies that have been released in 2020, so it'll take me a while to catch up. It may be the first year I've ever had where there's less than 100 movies total reviewed and ranked. I'm a huge movie buff, but with coronavirus and some of the viral concerns and the fact that, you know, some of the movie studios, they all have streaming services. Disney has both Hulu and Disney Plus. AT&T, which owns Warner Brothers and all the Warner properties, they own HBO. And there's HBO, there's HBO Go, there's HBO Now, there's about to be HBO Max. So they'll probably do what Amazon Prime does, which is release a few indie movies straight to that. You've seen basically all the big studios, they're creating their own streaming services, and they're going to start releasing more content directly to that. So it's almost like, well, movies, will that be a niche thing? Well, like the idea of getting in a car, going to the theater, buying a ticket, buying popcorn, buying a drink, will that go out the window? I personally hope not. I enjoy that experience, but I know a lot of people don't. I meet more and more people every day that be like, I hate going to the movies. It sucks. People are coughing. And now LA's got this fucking thing, reserved seating. I don't know if that's totally in the Southeast yet, but reserved seating is awful. Before you even get into the theater, you pick out, like, I want B4. And then you go into the theater and that's your seat and you have to sit there. And half the time I do that, the seat is itchy. I want to get up and move. Somebody will sit right beside me that just stinks of cigarette smoke. It looks like they just smoked a whole pack of Marlboros in the bathroom and they've come out there, like, there'll be kids or something in front of me or behind me. There's a whole bunch of reasons I don't want to sit in the seat that I actually picked out. And I hate reserved seating. And people always say, well, you know where the best seat in the house is? Your couch when you're at home and you're sitting at home watching a movie. Well, I have two small kids, and I know me and my wife, if we're ever trying to watch a movie, my son will come up and start talking to me, or my daughter will start crying, or my wife, you know, she's up, she's walking around, she's doing 10 other things. I don't agree with that experience because I think people are not really paying attention to a movie. It's hard to get lost when you're in your house, when you're in your own house. All the movies that come to Netflix, when I saw The Irishman, I paused it 10 times. You go use the bathroom, you go get popcorn, you go get a drink, and that almost disrupts the flow of the movie. It's hard to get totally encased in a movie. And Martin Scorsese, he was begging people, like, please don't watch on a smartphone, right? And I guarantee you there's people on the New York subway watching The Irishman on a smartphone on a really tiny screen. But it's just very hard to get totally lost into the experience of going to a movie when you're sitting in your living room. But I'm looking at it and I'm like, coronavirus, is it going to kill going to the movies? And a lot of people hate reserved seating. On Alabama Liberal's YouTube channel, the second most popular video I've ever released is about how much I hate reserved seating. So there's thousands of people that do not like reserved seating, at least thousands of people, probably millions. You have an industry that could change forever just based on this virus. Television and movies and entertainment and live venues. Well, all these musicians, they're doing concerts from their house and they're releasing them through streaming. I haven't been to a concert in years, probably 10 years. I was never like a huge live music fan. The older I get, the more that I change on that, by the way. Live music, has went from a plus to a deterrent. You know what I mean? Like, when I was younger, it'd be like, oh man, they're going to have a band. And now I'm almost like, oh shit, that's the place that's got a band. I don't want to go there. I want to go, like, you know, you want to go someplace quiet. Really has become almost a deterrent. I'm not a huge concert buff, but I could totally see people that are. They're almost like, wait a minute, I live in Ohio and this band I love, they're going to be in Philly for 2 nights. Rather than me going across state lines and getting a hotel and paying hundreds of dollars, why not pay $20 to stream that concert and watch it? And then, of course, that's what happens with movies. And with movies, there's more and more bootlegging. I think all these movies that are waiting to be released, like The Fast and the Furious 9, which probably going to be the worst movie of the year on AlabamaLiberal.com, spoiler alert, but the last two or three Fast and Furious movies, they've been right at the bottom or near the bottom of the Alabama Liberal worst movies of the year rankings. So I'm not saying I was looking forward to watching that, but by waiting from this year to release it all the way to next year, they run a real risk of that getting leaked. So there's bootlegging, people will leak that. Everybody and their brother has already watched it by like Halloween of this year. And then it's almost like, well, we're going to release this massive movie 6 months later after everybody's illegally downloaded it and watched it. So there is a real risk of that. Of course, with concerts, it'll be the same thing, where if that's where everybody's absorbing music and getting it. And also, it's kind of stupid to like pay money to watch a concert. Like, the whole thing is to be there in person. Sometimes you see on Netflix or different streamers, they'll put a play on there, like a Broadway play, and you'll think like, oh man, this is a great deal. This is something that if you went to Broadway and you paid $100 a ticket, but now you can watch it virtually for free on Netflix, and then you watch it and you're almost like, that almost wasn't worth watching for free. Like, that was almost not worth the time that it took to watch that. There's something about that live experience. And the same way I feel about movie theaters is probably the same way people who go to a concert. It's almost like, I don't want to pay $7. I don't want to pay $3. I don't want to pay any money to watch Bruce Springsteen sing songs through a video connection, through my laptop or whatever. Like, there is something about that live in-person experience. But the thing about it, millennials and Gen Z especially, we're already not the most social generations in the world. Like, we're already less social than the generations that came before us. And I guess my biggest fear with coronavirus is that it will make that even more true. I mean, you already have generations that, I sometimes call it soft autism. We don't touch each other the way that baby boomers. Like, sometimes you'll see cases where it'll almost be like Me Too cases. Like with Joe Biden, it'll be like, oh, he touched me on the back. And somebody of Joe Biden's generation, I guarantee you, thinks nothing about that. I guarantee you he does that to men and women. It's not just hot women he does that to. I guarantee you, like, if I met Joe Biden, it wouldn't be less than 10 minutes before he's got his hand on the back of my neck or something like that. And that's something that millennials just feel very uncomfortable with. Like, there's something about that that we don't like, being touched, because so much of our what we're doing is through a computer screen or it's over online. Back in episode, I believe it was 62, I talked about, I grew up with Facebook and social media, and before you even went on a date with a woman, first you're talking to her through Facebook for like a month before you even meet her. I'm sure older people look at that and they think, what the fuck is wrong with you people? But if you really look at the way that millennials, especially millennial women, date, it's almost like those things are inappropriate. Like, they say, don't catcall people, don't try to talk to them on the subway, don't try to talk to them on the street. If you work with them, stay away from them, don't ask them out. It's almost like it has to go through an online connection, because any other way, like, just, oh, I saw her at a bookstore and I'm going to come up, I'm going to talk to her. That's almost like stranger danger. Millennials were raised in a hypersensitive environment of every person who talks to you is trying to kidnap you. They're trying to get you in their van, and your parents will never see you again, and you will disappear from the face of the earth, so don't talk to that person. So there was already the child abductions of the 80s and 90s, which we saw in the news all the time. You know, my mom's like, hey, yeah, I used to get on my bicycle, and I'd ride my bicycle to school, and school was 2 miles away. Like, we look at that and think, are you fucking crazy? Are you nuts? It's amazing that you didn't disappear. And probably there were kids who did disappear, but they just weren't on the news. It wasn't advertised, and so it didn't seem as dangerous as it perhaps really was. And now we've got from being like, yeah, I'm gonna let my kid walk to school, which is a mile from the house, to being like, I need my teacher to wear a body vest that has a camera on it so I can see inside the classroom. Like, just going to a public restroom by themselves as I stand outside the door, that's too big of a risk to let them go by themselves. Even if I'm outside the door, right? Even if there's no back window, even if there's no way they could escape, somehow, some way, a child molester, he'll cut through the concrete part of a Costco bathroom to get my son out the door. They're grown up in a very hypersensitive, fearful, scary environment. Back when I was dating, you used to see that all the time. Let's go out on a date or whatever. And they'd be like, at nighttime? And I'd be like, yeah, sure, at nighttime. I don't feel comfortable with that. You talk to a girl every once in a while that wanted to meet in broad daylight in like the touristiest, most crowded. I don't know what they were expecting to happen. But I mean, you weren't even saying, come to a dark alley. You're like, let's go to a public restaurant in New York, which is one of the safest big cities in the world. There'll be hundreds of people around. And I'd be like, no, it needs to be 11 o'clock on a Sunday or otherwise I'm not going to show up. Caught that more with girls that lived in Long Island or Jersey City. Like it wasn't so much people who lived in Manhattan or in Brooklyn. They had that great urban energy or a risk is a risk, like we'll just have to take it or whatever. I noticed the more suburban that you got, like the more people were having to commute, the longer they were commuting into New York, the more scared they got and the more weird about it that they got. I'm sure that's true in LA and other cities as well, but I'm worried that that's going to become more and more true. And especially because millennials are a generation that famously, we live at home more than any other generation. Like you meet millennial people that are 40 years old and they live in a home. And for baby boomers or Gen X, you would almost say, hey, you're losers. And they're like, what are you talking about? Rent's expensive. And it's like, yeah, rent's expensive. It's always been expensive. And people have found ways to pay it, or they bought a place. They found some kind of a way that was between living on the street and living with your parents. Somewhere there was a third option of living on your own and a sense of being like, I'd rather die than live with my parents. And that really came with baby boomers and the silent generation and everything else. And of course, people say, well, they used to get married when they were 18. And if you live from a state like Alabama, that's still true. They get pregnant, right? Girls in my school, they would get pregnant at 18, 19, 20. Then they might get married 6 months later or whatever. But now millennials, it's almost like, yeah, I had a kid with this guy, but I'm still living at home. Don't you know that mom loves that? Grandma at 45 years old is just in love with that idea, being like, yeah, let me have my daughter and her loser boyfriend who's not married to her and their kids in the house. Like, oh boy, you know, it's weird. People pick and choose. They take some aspects that are traditional and some aspects that are progressive and they meld them into whatever works for them. Those same people will be like, yeah, well, whatever happened to family values? At least we're living together. Yeah, you're living with your mom. People pick and choose and do what they want to do. But I'm worried that with millennials who are already more sensitive to touch, they're already more leery of just taking risks, just being out there, just doing things that are fun. You almost meet like older people that are more fun than some millennials are. Yeah, well, you know, this guy, he asked me to go somewhere with him. And now we just went to Las Vegas. Mom, you went to Las Vegas with a guy you just met and you didn't even Facebook him for 2 months first and look up his background information and get a full report of who that guy is and his social security number and shit. And so it's weird. It's almost like we've become more lame, more square, more risk averse. Everything we do is through a computer screen. Even our battles take place on Twitter. There'll be millennials, and I know this for a fact, in person, people will not argue with me. They will not argue with me. They will not get into it with me. They will not talk shit about me. And they'll say something to my face that's nice and pleasant and maybe make a fake smile or whatever and walk off. 2 weeks later, blast me on Twitter or through Facebook or through emails or something like that. So even our conflicts go through computer screens. Like people don't even want to do that. So with coronavirus, you could be seeing an entire generation who is already overly comfortable with everything going through a computer screen and everything going through online and never being in the same room with each other. I saw somebody write an article, be like, well, I think there's going to be a baby boom from coronavirus because they're in close quarters and they're trapped together. They got nothing to do but have sex. And I'm like, yeah, I think you'll see, rather than a baby boom, you'll see a divorce boom is what I'm projecting. We're already a generation that is overly comfortable with the idea of never touching, never being around each other, never being in the same room. And this is just going to make that even worse. And that's scary to me. I mean, I'm not a fan of that. I already feel like you see baby boomers, they come up to each other, they give each other a big hug. Like when they meet each other, Joe Biden's like, hey, I'm a hugger, I'm a toucher, I'm a feeler. And when he says that, you see millennial girls, they cringe. I mean, they make a face. I don't give them a hug. I don't even shake their hand unless they offer it. And I almost wish I could be more like that. Like I almost wish it was normal to come up and give somebody a hug. And you know, it's almost a colder generation to be raised up in that way. Sometimes a two-faced generation in that. I'm sure Joe Biden, he come up, he gives somebody a hug. In the moment, they'll be like, oh, hey, Joe, how's it going? And then 2 days later, write like a 4,000-word article on the Huffington Post about it. And that's kind of what's happened. I mean, other than Bernie Sanders dropping out, the second biggest political news was this Tara Reid story, which this woman is making this shit up. There's no way this woman's telling the truth. People say, well, you don't know that. I do know that. And I'll tell you how I know that. Her story went from, for 20 years, because she worked for Joe Biden in 1993. I was 7 years old at the time she worked for Joe Biden. Everything she said about Joe Biden was, he's a great guy, he's wonderful, I had a good time working with him, blah, blah, blah. always positive. In 2019, first it became, she wrote a post for Medium that was about how Joe Biden, she didn't like working with him because his views on Russia were bad. She goes, I liked working with him as a person, but his views on Russia, they're not the same as mine. Now, I've written my own Medium article, and it has zero views. It was about my experience with Campbell Hall. It's so funny, too, because everywhere I went talking about the experience with Campbell Hall, these people were like, you should write a post for Medium. Medium's the place to air this shit. Yeah, because they knew that nobody would read it. They knew that was a good place to dump something. I could write something for my own website and have more people listen to it and read it. And they did. When I did a podcast episode about it, I had way more people listen to it and hear about it. Of course, most of those people live in the Southeast, and they're not looking at private schools in Los Angeles or whatever. So it's almost like people agreed with me when they heard the story. But I wanted people who were actually looking at schools in LA to hear it and respond to it. And Medium, they said, was a great place to do that. And it wasn't at all. Nobody cares. Totally useless. Because every post that I get from Medium, they send me all this spam. I had to block them. But it'll be something like the right way to relationship stuff. It's like the stuff that Cosmo and Vogue used to write. All stuff about like, oh, 10 signs to tell he's cheating on you in coronavirus quarantine. Here's a good sign to know he's cheating on you. If he says, I have to leave the house. When there's no reason to leave the house. All the stores are shut down and there's nowhere to go. And honestly, it was totally useless. But she wrote a Medium post about how her disagreements with Joe Biden were philosophical. It was nothing to do with anything he had done. Then 6 months later, she comes out and says, yeah, he was always touching us and he would touch my hair and he'd give us pats on the shoulder and he'd touch our back. And then, as his campaign with Bernie is intensifying this year, she comes back and says, he pinned me up against a wall and he inserted his finger into my vagina, which is sexual assault. But she never said anything like that. Her story first goes from, Joe Biden's a great guy. I just don't want to work for him anymore. This is from 1993 to 2019, more than 20 years. This is almost 30 years that she's telling the same story about working for this guy. Then she says that it's philosophical differences because she likes Russia and Joe Biden doesn't. She says Putin's a great guy. Now, I don't know how this doesn't set off any red flags. Once again, we have somebody who's overly complimentary of Russia and Joe Biden, who Russia clearly does not want to be president. We've already had an impeachment trial over this same thing. Like, I don't know why this doesn't set off any red flags, as it should have with Hillary. I mean, it's like the media can't learn. It's like they can't learn anything new. They can't see, like, hey, maybe this was a pattern with, you know, Russia trying to fuck up Hillary back in 2016. Maybe they're trying to do the same thing with this woman who's overly complimentary of Russia, talking about how great they are. And then 6 months later, he comes out and says something different about, oh, Joe Biden, he was touching the women in the office. He was making us uncomfortable. But nobody cared about that because they knew Joe Biden was a toucher, was a feeler, was a hugger. Keep in mind, we've not had anyone say anything about he crossed the line. He forced me to have sex with him. He said, have sex, Samir, you're fired. He pinned me up against the wall. So nobody cared about the same thing that people have been saying about him. So then now this year, as she's trying to help Bernie Sanders, because she's a hardcore Bernie Sanders fan, this woman, Tara Reid, and she's on a podcast with a woman who's a hardcore Bernie Sanders fan. And she comes out and says, he pinned me against a wall, inserted his finger into my vagina. It's a sexual assault. It's as bad as what Kavanaugh did. Except Joe Biden's a grown man and this woman works underneath him and it's worse, but she's lying. And the reason I know that is because what happened with us at Campbell Hall and that story, first I told every lawyer in Los Angeles who would listen and I told the same story. Then I told every reporter in Los Angeles who would listen and I told the same story. Then I told every government agency in California who would listen and I told the same story. Then I went to Medium and wrote the same story almost verbatim as I did for my Better Business Bureau complaint, as I have for my complaint to the Department of Education. I told that story so many times and it has almost never changed. 95% of it is exactly the same except for a couple of the details you may forget here and there, but the story is the same, the bulk of it, because it's the truth. It's what happened. I have emails to prove that that's what happened. I have documents to prove that that's what happened. Nobody says I'm making it up. They just say there's nothing we can do about it. She comes out and changed her story 4 times in 1 year. From Joe Biden's a great guy, to we have philosophical differences, to he touched me inappropriately, to he committed sexual assault. So every time she tells a story, it gets 10 times worse than it ever was. And every time she tells a story, it depends on if she's trying to help Bernie Sanders or not. The more and more she's trying to help him. This is what I like that Bernie Sanders has finally dropped out. And this is why I wish he'd done it a month ago. All these people like Joe Rogan and the podcast woman that the Tara Reid was talking to, they all pretend like, oh, we're helping Bernie Sanders. We're helping him defeat Joe Biden. This will somehow pull out a last minute miracle victory that's never going to happen. And people will see Joe Biden for how awful he really is. And they'll vote for Bernie and it'll be Bernie versus Trump. Now that Bernie's quit, they officially know that delusion will not happen. And it wasn't going to happen to begin with. But they were fooling themselves, and that's how they were able to present it to people. But now that Bernie's out, people can't pretend like, oh, we're not helping Trump anymore. They have to face what they were always doing, helping Donald Trump beat Joe Biden. That's what these people were always doing, and now they have nowhere to go. I know this has been kind of a long preamble, but one thing that I definitely wanted to talk about was we need to change the primary. If you listen to every podcast episode that I do, every fifth one, like I said, has predictions. I want to predict, I think this will happen, and I hope it will happen. What I predict will happen is that the next time we have a real race, depends on if Joe Biden, if he wins, if he runs for a second term. So we might have a real one in 2024. We might have a real one in 2028. But the next time we have a real race, I don't want the Iowa caucus to go first. And I don't think they will go first. I think this last Iowa caucus debacle, episode 55, is, I call it the Iowa clusterfuck, because that's what happened. And it was a disaster. And now we have another case where the Iowa caucus has leaned towards a candidate that is not the eventual nominee. And if you look at the Iowa caucus, they are historically horrible at predicting who the nominee will be. They didn't go for Ronald Reagan in 1980. They didn't go for George H.W. Bush in 1988. They didn't go for Bill Clinton in 1992. The only times that they've really been accurate in terms of not just who the nominee for a party will be, but who will win the general election for the presidency, is Barack Obama in 2008. Now, some people might say, well, what about Bush in 2000? Depends on if you think Bush won or not. I don't happen to believe he actually won. That we put an asterisk beside, because him and Gore were essentially tied. The Supreme Court came in and rigged it for Bush. So really, you can only say Barack Obama in 2008, since they've been going first for the entirety of my lifetime. 40 years, they've been going first, and they've been fucking it up every step of the way. They are not a good predictor of how the parties will actually vote. South Carolina is way better, especially for the Democratic Party. In my lifetime, the only time that somebody from South Carolina lost it and then went on to win the nomination was John Kerry in 2004, and he's the only Democrat in my lifetime to lose the popular vote. Next up would be Michael Dukakis, who also didn't win South Carolina in 1988. He also lost the popular vote. When you look at South Carolina, they are way better in terms of not just who the nominee will be, but if they will win a general election, which is one reason I'm very bullish on Joe Biden's chances. You look at John Kerry, you look at Michael Dukakis. South Carolina, you can almost make a case, should go first. I want to propose a different system. I don't think this will happen. My prediction is that Iowa will no longer go first, or if they go first, they will say, you have to be a primary system. No more of this Iowa caucus bullshit. Two of the only caucuses in this entire system, Nevada and Iowa, went first, and they voted for Bernie Sanders, a guy who could not win a primary state. Other than Vermont and New Hampshire and a couple of really small western states, he's not won a single primary other than that. I don't think a caucus state will go first anymore. Currently, Nevada or Iowa goes first. They will force them to go to a primary system. I want to propose a different system. I want to propose the alphabetical primary. I think Alabama should go first. You could do an alphabetical primary. Alabama goes first. Wyoming goes last. Do it in a more condensed time frame. So this whole thing of doing it like from basically the end of January all the way to June, that shit's over with. I think you hit it hard, 50 states in 3 months, perhaps even less than that, but 3 months tops, alphabetical primary system. Alabama goes first. Then you do Alaska, then you do Arizona. Arizona is a huge purple state. One of the big eight purple states is already out of the way. The system we have now kind of sucks, because you go from Iowa to New Hampshire to Nevada. And people might say, but New Hampshire and Iowa and Nevada, those are all purple states. How can you say that that's not a good system? Those states are irrelevant. If you really wanted to go for who will be the next president of the United States, you would advocate a system more like Florida and Ohio and Virginia go for Pennsylvania. You just do four big purple states, let them vote, and then be done with the whole thing. Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada, these are all outlier states. They're almost irrelevant. But Alabama, it has the right mix. It's got a good racial mix. There's a huge black population inside the state of Alabama. And they also do well on the Republican side as well. I mean, they went for Trump, which the Iowa caucus didn't go for him. They went for Reagan, which the Iowa caucus didn't go for him. You could say that they have as good a predictor for who the Republican nominee and the eventual president will be, better than Iowa. George H.W. Bush, they went for him in 88, which the Iowa caucus didn't. They're almost as good for Republicans as they are for Democrats. So it makes more sense to be like, okay, they have the right racial mix for Democrats. The whole thing with Iowa and New Hampshire, they're overwhelmingly white. They'll go for candidates like Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders, which almost always tank in terms of the whole general primary and stuff. This was what we learned in 2016. This is what we learned in 2004. We learned this over and over again, and yet it makes no difference. We never change it. Alabama has the right racial mix. It's the right size. It's not tiny. geographically big enough, and population-wise, Alabama is almost exactly in the middle. I think it's 24th or 25th. It's the right population because it's not massive like California. The biggest reason that they keep Iowa and New Hampshire is they say, well, you know, if you don't do that, then all these small campaigns, they're all going to get crowded out. Of course, that's been happening anyway. In the American presidency, you have to have millions and millions. It's not going to be the case where it's like John Delaney, he won the Iowa caucus, and then he goes on and wins the whole general election. If you don't have millions and millions of dollars and name brand recognition and the whole country doesn't know you, it's all going to fall apart anyway. It'll just happen sooner and it'll weed people out faster. But the media markets in California, like San Francisco and Los Angeles, they're way too expensive. The population's too much. It's too big geographically. You can't spread out enough. You have to have a massive campaign, so it shouldn't go first. So Alabama's the right size. The population-wise, it's just right. The media markets are inexpensive. The cost of living is inexpensive. You have a state where the racial diversity is the right mix. It's a way better predictor than Iowa for the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of who they'll pick for their nominations and also who will actually win a general election. So for all these reasons, Alabama is way better than the Iowa caucus. And then after you do that, the alphabetical primary system, you move to Alaska. There's your funny, weird outlier state. So you get that out of the way. Then you go to Arizona. A huge purple state that's going to be a big prize. Don't you want to know, like, how will the candidates actually do in a real purple state? Then you get Arkansas, and then you start getting Connecticut and California and a couple of the bigger states. Already, in just 6 or 7 states, you're already getting more geographic diversity than the current system. It's very similar to the current system, except more geographic diversity, more racial diversity. Wyoming goes last, but that's as it should be. Washington goes second to last, but it already is a little bit of an outlier state in a lot of ways. You'll have a way better system, and it'll be more fair and more equitable, because now the big question is always, well, why does Iowa go first if they're always wrong and they fuck up the results? You see all these Iowa bars and taverns and diners. Joe Biden comes in and it's like, who's Joe Biden? I never met him before. I don't even know who he is. Yeah, it's kind of a terrible system to have this state go first. It'll be more fair. If everything's in alphabetical order, the fairness comes in. And you'll still have the biggest purple states in the country, like Ohio and Pennsylvania. I mean, they'll still be basically in the middle, which is about where they are now. So things are not really going to change for them that much. It won't change for New York that much. There'll be a couple states that become less important, but Alabama would just assume the role that it does. And I'm going to tell you right now, Alabama, Iowa, I know that those people, those bitter Midwestern folks, they're always like, oh, here comes the presidential candidates and here comes all the attention and we don't like it. We can't stand it. Alabama would fucking love to be in the center of things. Can you imagine if politicians had to spend a year in Alabama going to the Iron Bowl and talking about the Alabama-Auburn rivalry? We would love it. All that attention, all that money coming to us for once, a long neglected state, too neglected nationally. We never get any attention. We never get any money. Politicians act like we don't care unless there's a tornado or something that comes through. But that doesn't have to be the case. That could change tomorrow. With more and more car manufacturing coming, Toyota dealerships and things like that coming, things could change tomorrow. And we would love the attention and the money. Iowa, like, other than corn, I think their second biggest thing is the presidential election in terms of their economy, because millions and millions of dollars get sunk into it every single cycle, every single system. They vote. A candidate gets a small bump out of that for about half a week, then New Hampshire votes. Everybody forgets about Iowa again, but people campaigning it. This last system was horrible. You saw Pete Buttigieg practically living there for a year trying to get a bump out of Iowa. They fuck up the results. The night of the election, nobody knows who wins. The next day, everybody's already forgotten about it. They moved on to New Hampshire, so there was almost no bump out of that. Let Alabama do that. Let candidates come to us and spend millions and millions of dollars and just set their money on fire, and then, you know, have their campaign staff staying in all these hotels, filling up our hotels, giving us money, buying ads in our media market. It's rising those up. It could transform the state because Iowa's cold. It's depressing. They're basically a one crop economy. They got their corn and nothing else. Alabama, like, we could really benefit from something like what they'd be doing. It would single-handedly probably pull Alabama where we're at in terms of national rankings. It's getting better all the time. Like, we used to be 5th from the bottom in terms of standard of living and the economics. Now with the Toyota plants and all the car dealerships and things like that coming, it gets a little bit better every single time. But I guarantee you, if you have politicians that have to make a big splash in Alabama, Alabama is no longer the redheaded stepchild of the country anymore. It's no longer the bastard. That can go to Mississippi, or that can go to Wyoming, or that can go somewhere else. But if we're first in the nation in terms of the presidential elections, politicians being like, well, how come we're putting this new military base in Wyoming? Well, I think we should put that in Alabama, don't you? No sense. senator who is even thinking about running for president is going to want to do something to hurt their standing in Alabama, which is how it goes for Iowa, which is why we have farmers being paid to grow corn, which we don't fucking need, and they're being paid not to grow certain other crops. All of our agricultural system is kind of centered around Iowa. You can get a way better crop yield out of indoor farms, greenhouse farms. I've seen Elon Musk's brother, Kimball Musk, he's able to grow leafy greens in a damn storage container. For all these reasons and more, you'd start centering the country around a state that probably has like a way better future and a way more diverse economy. So do I think Alabama will go first in the nation in 2024, 2028? No, I sure don't. But I'd like to go ahead and kick off the idea and at the very least get the first presidential primary out of Iowa, which has been proven inefficient. And thanks for listening. Stay tuned for episode 66, which is coming up shortly.